This is a podcast from ABC Overnights.
Now, over the last few years, we've had some very powerful and emotional royal commissions which have revealed all types of horrors. The Royal Commission into Misconduct in the Banking, Superannuation and Financial Services Industry, also known as the Banking Royal Commission and the Hayne Royal Commission, uncovered some horrific behaviour that had us all gobsmacked. Recently, there have been further royal commissions undertaken into aged care, and another will soon look at violence, abuse, neglect and exploitation of people with disability, backed by a $528 million budget. What then is the purpose of a royal commission? Together today, we'll find out as we discuss the functions of royal commissions in our democratic process with Suri Ratnapala, Emeritus Professor of Public Law at the University of Queensland in Brisbane. Professor Ratnapala, welcome to Overnights.
Good morning.
Very kind of you to join us in the early hours of this morning to tell us almost, I suppose in many ways, everything we've always wanted to know about royal commissions and why they carry so much gravitas. Firstly, what can you tell us about the history of royal commissions? Do we know when the very first one was?
It all goes back to England, actually. The monarch had the royal prerogative to appoint commissions to look into affairs of the kingdom. And it's been done from the time of William the Conqueror. It's been done from time to time whenever the government of the day wanted to investigate some aspect of public life. With Federation, the Parliament of Australia, Commonwealth Parliament, passed the Royal Commissions Act in 1902. So it goes back from, in Australia. It was formalised in 1902 by the Royal Commissions Act, and since then it has been put to use a number of times over the years. And as you mentioned, more recently, it has gained much publicity in the Banking Royal Commission and aged care and so forth.
What is it about them? What sort of powers do they have that any other inquiry just doesn't seem to be able to produce the same results?
There are all sorts of inquiries that governments conduct and departments and ministerial bodies and so forth. Royal Commission is quite special because it has powers granted by law that the other committees and inquiries don't have. Let me just give you four of the main aspects of this. A Royal Commission can summon witnesses to give evidence. It can require witnesses to produce documents or even things. It can require witnesses to give evidence on oath and affirmation. And also, if witnesses do not do so, or if people try to disrupt the work of the commission, it can report them to the courts where it's punishable by the courts. So it's the coercive powers, the powers to compel people to come forth and assist the commission is its main strength.
To jump to the end then, once a royal commission delivers its findings and recommendations, do they directly have the power to have people punished by law and appear by the courts, or do they make recommendations to another authority which must decide whether to act on them?
They certainly do not have the power to enforce its own recommendations. The Royal Commission is not a court, so it does not have the power of punishment or enforcement. What the Royal Commission does is to present a report, in the case of Australia, to the Governor General, which then requires to be presented in Parliament. What happens then is its recommendations are considered by the authorities, relevant authorities. If there are if there is evidence of criminal actions disclosed in the evidence, in the report, it would be the duty of the prosecutors, the public prosecution, as a department of the government to pursue them in the courts, complete investigations. It will assist the enforcement of the law, but it, by itself it will not enforce it. Then on the policy side, Royal Commission reports usually recommend changes to policy, new methods of doing things, and reform of systems. And then it's up to the government to bring necessary legislation or make necessary administrative arrangements to implement them. So that's the end result of a Royal Commission.
Do they usually have narrow or broad guidelines under which they operate?
The terms, it depends on the terms of reference. Sometimes it's quite broad, like we saw in the Banking Royal Commission. Sometimes it could be the investigation of a particular event. For example, the UN Oil for Food Program and the Chamberlain convictions, for example, were quite specific. On Royal Commissions, with respect to Royal Commissions on policy, they could be quite wide-ranging.
And given some of the things you've told us about the things that they can and cannot do, why do so many people hold them up as the holy grail of finding the truth?
It's because that Royal Commissions fill a gap in the constitutional scheme of things. Courts are the courts of law are the main mechanism of finding truth as regards criminal matters, criminal allegations, and civil disputes. But courts cannot investigate matters of public importance on its own. The cases must come before the courts, before the courts can investigate and resolve them. So there is a wide area of matters that are not amenable to judicial resolution. So mind you, we must not forget that there are other means of finding the facts as relating to public affairs. There are parliamentary commissions, parliamentary committees that inquire. There are permanent committees like the Productivity Commission and the Human Rights Commission. There are many ways of doing such things, but some of them are permanent. Royal commissions are brought to use when something happens that for which there is an urgent need for investigation, and the other, and I suppose the other thing is Royal Commissions have an aura of authority since it was initiated by the monarch, and in our case, by the Governor General.
We often hear, Professor, of people calling for a Royal Commission into this or that, and sometimes for what appears to be very flippant reasons. Are people too careless about the subjects that they think should be looked at by a Royal Commission?
I think there is some of that happening. People who are deeply concerned personally by some aspect of public administration might want to take it straight to a Royal Commission, which means that it will be public. It will have the appearance, of impartiality, independence from the political process. It has a certain authority in the public opinion that which other means of investigation doesn't have. So I think there is a certain tendency to bring up the option of a royal commission far too easily.
But then at the same time, how is it decided that a royal commission is what is needed?
It's up to the government and public opinion. Ultimately, it's the Governor General's decision, but the Governor General must act on the advice of the Executive Council. Now, the Executive Council consists mainly of the ministers of the cabinet and as well as other ministers. So the Governor General cannot appoint a royal commission by his or her own authority or discretion.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the government that eventually decides whether or not to have a royal commission. But mind you, the governments are guided by, most of the time, not always, by public opinion, and the pressure of public opinion can result in a royal commission, like you saw in the Banking Royal Commission, where the government initially was not inclined to have a royal commission, but I think public opinion had the last word.
They can be initiated at a state level too, can't they? A premier advising a governor that it's appropriate to have a royal commission?
Yes. In fact, state royal commissions were in existence before the Commonwealth Royal Commission Act. We have to remember that Australia was not a federation, but a set of colonies, British colonies, and each colony had its own representative of the monarch, the governor, and its own legislature and government, and there were royal commissions in the states long before there were in the Commonwealth.
Mm. If you'd like to join this discussion, the number is 1-300-800-222, 1-300-800-222. You may have a question directly for Professor Ratnapala, or you may have a comment of your own to make. Have you been involved in a royal commission? Has a royal commission looked into the industry that you work in or to an aspect of your life? What was the impact, if any, of that royal commission on you and on your industry or that aspect of your life, maybe a nursing home or a bank or something like that? 1-300-800-222 is the number if you'd like to call. You can also send me a text if you like on 0467 922 702, the text number 0467 922 702. Alan's with us in Benalla this morning. Morning to you, Alan.
Good morning.
You want to talk about the Royal Commission into unions, did you?
Yeah, into the construction unions.
Yep.
The Coal Royal Commission was sent by John Howard to Melbourne CBD, and when they got there, they found there were three unions who were cooperating on job safety analyses, actually industrial safety. That work actually represents an unfunded productivity gain for employers. But the thing about it is the CFMEU is probably the only remaining union which has not been subjugated. So that's probably the reason that we've got stagnant wages growth.
And you're blaming the Royal Commission for that?
I'm blaming the situation where the CFMEU has been targeted, and the Royal Commission was there to find something wrong with the union. When they found something right, they didn't comment on it.
All right, I shall take that as a comment. Alan, thank you very much. In Benalla, 1-300-800-222. Professor, they cost a lot of money. As I mentioned, the latest one to be announced, which will look at violence, abuse, neglect and exploitation of people with disability, has a budget of $528 million, over $500 million. Are they value for money?
It's difficult to say. Some of these investigations obviously can be carried out by departmental resources and departmental staff and or special committees of independent advisors, which of course would be very much cheaper. It's a question of public confidence in the process that requires a Royal Commission, and Royal Commissions have to be independent, and they have to engage people of stature and ability and competence. Usually they are experts of the highest caliber, perhaps even and often retired judges, and they have to be assisted by lawyers and experts. So all of that costs a lot of money. Some commissions, obviously, by judging by their results, have been obviously great value for money. Some commission reports have laid there without any action being taken, and obviously they're waste money. So it's not easy to say. There was an inquiry into royal commissions about 3 or 4 years ago, conducted by the Australian Law Reform Commission, and this is one of the issues that they considered. And they recommended a system where the costs of a royal commission is evaluated and then reported on, the value for money aspect to be more taken more seriously. That report, I'm not sure what has happened to it or to what extent it has been implemented.
Gee, that's interesting, an inquiry into the effectiveness of royal commissions.
Yes, it is indeed.
Interesting one there. Of course, some people are concerned that often they're politically motivated, and I think that's the line that Chandra in Canberra wants to take this morning. Chandra, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Yeah, Tony, what's your contribution?
After 2013, when former Prime Minister Tony Abbott won the government, and he created the Royal Commission $400 million or something about against union and against being bad. This look like a political motivation or like any achievement on that one?
I'm sorry, so you're asking how political these can be, the motivation for royal commissions at times?
Yes. All right.
Okay, I'll put that to Professor Ratnapala. How much does politics come into play into whether we have a royal commission or not?
Yes, I think directly or indirectly, politics plays part. A government might want to shift the responsibility for a difficult decision to a royal commission, or it might want to investigate or bring to the public notice or to subject political opponents to some sort of public exposure. There could be instances where the government wishes to lay the groundwork for a policy initiative and to get legitimacy for it. In various ways, governments obviously can use the Royal Commission process to further its objectives.
But that can backfire, surely.
That can certainly backfire. And an independent commission might come up with recommendations that is not the liking of the government and might in fact work against the government's established policy.
Do most of the royal commissions travel as well? I mean, a couple of recent ones like the banking one and the looking at sexual abuse in institutions held hearings all around Australia, and I suppose that's one of the reasons they can take up to several years to conclude and then make findings. Does that add to the expense, but is that a necessary expense that they must travel widely?
Certain types of inquiries by their nature would require extensive investigations in the locations in which the activities take place, and that's unavoidable, and they're necessary. I wouldn't say that it's an unnecessary expenditure. It would be, in fact, an essential expenditure given the nature of the inquiry. But by and large, royal commissions can summon people to give evidence from wherever they are. travel to the location of the Royal Commission, compel their attendance and ask for evidence and documents and so forth. So largely Royal Commissions are able to get their work done from one place, but given the nature of some of the investigations, they really should be going to the locations.
Our number is 1-300-800-222. That's the number Debbie in Brisbane has called. Good morning to you, Debbie. You have some questions about personalising them nowadays.
Yes, I do. Thank you, Tony. Tony, I have two questions for the professor. The first one, particularly around social issues in the case of the child abuse in institutions, the Banking Royal Commission. Then there's the aged care we've currently got underway and the future Disability Care Royal Commission. Now, they're very, very personal. And what I've seen in recent times, and I'm just wondering whether this is a reflection of public demand, is that we're allowing personal testimonials, that it does humanise it. It does actually bring it down to a level we all understand. And I would imagine that they are probably more successful because we can relate to the stories that are coming out, not all of us, but in many cases we would know somebody that has had some engagement with this particular matter. Mm.
Let's get Professor Ratnapala's response to that first before we go to your second question, if that's okay. Professor, what do you think about what Debbie's just said?
I think one of the great benefits or advantages of a Royal Commission is it's independent. And it can go into matters where governments either are not fully competent or they are prevented from looking into them because of the particular way in which the interests of parties operate. For example, a department might not be able to investigate itself because the people involved are in the department. And in such cases, there's almost no way in which which citizens can have confidence in what is being investigated. And in the examples that the listener just gave, there was no possibility really of an independent inquiry being conducted into those matters. And I think it's quite right that people have confidence in Royal Commissions precisely because they're able to look into matters that affect the personal lives of people and do it impartially. And these are matters in which are certainly with regard to disability abuse and aged care abuses. They're not really political matters, and they're personal matters, and I think the Royal Commission process is quite appropriate for that.
Mm. There certainly has been some very powerful and personal evidence given in some of the more recent Royal Commissions, as you mentioned, Debbie. What was the second point you wanted to put to the Professor?
Tony, that was what the Professor said was a nice segue into my second question, is that, this is just my assumption, that very much Royal Commissions are called when governments are left with virtually no other option, and I wonder whether it is a representation of a failure of a system. So the integrity of the system that governs whatever the particular issue that the Royal Commission will be called for has failed, so it's been compromised. And I think we've seen that through the Royal Commission into financial institutions and certainly with aged care. It just seems it doesn't matter how much money is thrown at a situation, doesn't matter how many checks and balances they put into place, there is a lot of slippage and people drop through the net. And so I feel it is a reflection of failure somewhere along the way.
Professor, are they the result or the end result of failings?
Well, I suppose we have to understand that no system is perfect, no government is perfect, no democracy is perfect. And that's why we need these extra precautions and institutions to try to rectify what goes wrong. So Royal Commissions is one of the important ways of addressing the failures of government or the failures of other aspects of society.
Institutions like the banks and the churches.
Banks and yes, and even what happens in society generally.
Yeah, fair enough. And things that need to be better can be improved, hopefully, as a result of a Royal Commission. I'll just read this text from Rod from Irwin in Western Australia. He says, Royal Commissions seem to be a useful tool in bringing the truth out of certain happenings. To go to all of that effort and expense, it is important that the subject is not frivolous, and we can see that the Banking Royal Commission and the Aged Care Royal Commission were overdue in being called because of the end result. Who would have thought that banks were so corrupt? Public opinion showed that not only those that did not want the results known were against it, and ironically, there probably should be a Royal Commission into why they cost so much, because it certainly seems the cost is ridiculous and there are a lot of fat cats getting fatter from them. And I think, Rod, you may have sent your text around the same time that I put to Professor Ratnapala, the cost, and are they worth it? Do they deliver value for money? So we may have already addressed the point you're making there. This is Overnights on ABC Radio. I'm Tony Arthur, filling in for Rod Quinn this weekend and next. And this morning we're talking about Royal Commissions. I'm interested to hear the impact, if any, they've had on your life. What do you make about Royal Commissions, especially since we've had so many of late, and as Debbie said, so many touching on deeply personal aspects. Everything you've always wanted to know about a Royal Commission, if you'd like to call 1300 800 222 or 1300 800 222. The text line is 0467 922 702. And another text, Shane from Perth, says, unfortunately, because the terms of reference are set by the government of the day, the outcomes can be skewed even though the commission is independent. Can the terms of reference be set by anyone other than the government of the day? They can't, can they, Professor? It's up to the government of the day to set the guidelines and the terms of reference, isn't it?
Certainly it is. But of course, public opinion and political pressure can have an effect on the government in choosing the scope of an inquiry. So the parliament has a role to play in that, and so has public opinion.
Rightio. On the line is Nathan from Launceston. Morning, Nathan.
Hi, how you going?
Well, thanks. You reckon Royal Commissions are a measure of nothing being done for too long.
Yeah, basically exactly the same as what Debbie said. It just seems like the systematic failure for way too long. And it's like, and then you want to splash out, hundreds of millions of dollars to try and fix the situation. Personally, I don't think if you actually sort of hit the nail on the head at the time, as it was happening, that these things probably wouldn't have ballooned out as bad as they have.
Mm.
The other point I just wanted to add was, I lived in the NT for 8 years, and we had the Royal Commission into youth in detention.
Yep.
And it's all well and good to do a Royal Commission into something, but don't hang the towns and communities out to dry. After you finish with it, they closed down detention centres, and some of the youth that were in there for whatever reason, some of them were released because they deemed them, unnecessarily, imprisoned or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And now there is no repercussion. So every year since the start of the Royal Commission, it has been absolute hell. At night in Alice Springs, Tennant Creek is basically shutting down on the daily. Alice Springs is closing up. People are getting the hell out.
So it becomes a form of unintended collateral damage, you reckon?
Well, yeah, and the not one single member of parliament, not a single person in the whole of Alice Springs ever said anything about it in parliament, except, one. Robin Lambley, she said she brought it up about youth crime on numerous occasions and said, when is the government going to put through something that doesn't last for a couple of months and then disappear? It seems like only grants are being given to people. They put the money in their pocket. They do nothing. The program shuts down. And then the cycle begins again.
All right, Nathan, I think we get your point. Thank you very much for sharing. I might just go back to Professor Ratnapala. Are there sometimes unintended collateral damage, which is negative, Professor?
Yes, of course. As with any policy initiative of a government. And that's why I think we have to be careful about the use of any system. Sometimes, of course, you simply don't have the information that you require to make sound policy decisions. And of course, we have to remember that the ultimate responsibility lies not with the Royal Commission, but with legislators and governments. And that's what democracy is all about. Our democracy works well when there is accountability and public information and pressure, and politicians and administrators respond to that. As I said before, it's not a perfect system, our democracy. It has its advantages, some tremendous advantages, but it is something that that constantly requires attention and improvement and scrutiny. It's not always. Royal commissions are not always the ultimate solution.
Mm. Another text message brings us back to the politics behind royal commissions. Daniel in Bendigo says, "Are royal commissions often just a protracted and exorbitantly expensive forum for deflecting political heat and arriving at recommendations about issues which government has already received numerous reports and recommendations about previously?" And his example is the Northern Territory Youth Detention Royal Commission. Wouldn't the resources of government be better invested in just fixing the issues rather than continuing to inquire and make yet further recommendations about those issues, given insufficient resources are often the reason for the issues? And even once recommendations are made, insufficient resources are allocated to those recommendations. Is Daniel right there? Often with the recommendations of a royal commission, does there have to be follow through that can be not properly funded, Professor?
Yes. Royal Commission reports sometimes are difficult to implement the recommendations, and sometimes they are inconvenient for the governments from a policy angle. So therefore, Royal Commissions can be somewhat of a waste of funding. It's one of the matters that the Australian Law Reform Commission had a close look at. And it's got a set of recommendations about how to manage the costs of royal commissions. It's a very, very long report, 600 pages, so it's not easy to read and absorb. But there is a set of, there is a summary of recommendations that the public should perhaps be aware of.
Quite a few people sending the same text in simply saying we need a royal commission into royal commissions. Is that realistic?
That's exactly what was intended in the Australian Law Reform Commission.
That's what the Law Reform Commission did, yeah. Speaking again, their outcomes or findings were a bit obscure?
No, they were not obscure, I'm not entirely sure whether the motivation to implement all of those recommendations are there in the government. And that's been there for about 3 years now. I don't think quite enough public attention has been directed towards that report, which is a very valuable document. Public attention should be drawn to it, and also government should take it seriously.
On the text line, Susie asks, could the professor comment on why the insurance industry was so quote-unquote skimmed over, as it was, in the Banking Royal Commission? Your thoughts, Professor?
I wouldn't be able to answer that question because I was not privy to what went on there. And of course, different interests do play their part in Royal Commission investigations. So I'm afraid I wouldn't have much to say on that.
Fair enough. If you're not aware, we don't want you to go where you don't know. All royal commissions are political, says Peter. The party in power determines terms of reference, appoints the commissioner, provides funding and sets the end date. 1-300-800-222 is my number if you'd like to join this discussion. Our guest this morning for our talking point is Emeritus Professor of Public Law at the University of Queensland, and that is Suri Ratnapala, as we talk about royal commissions and their impact and effectiveness over the years and why indeed we have them and why they carry so much gravitas. Let's talk to Alex in Elwood this morning. You're wondering about how many royal commissions we can have going at any one time, are you, Alex?
Yes, indeed. That's right, yes, because I was thinking perhaps the latest commission, which was announced by Scott Morrison, was a strategic move to prevent more than one commission from occurring at the same time. Perhaps I was thinking maybe he is trying to tie up this facility of royal commissions for the next 3 years, as you say, that to prevent a Labour Party, which could quite possibly be in government soon, to prevent Labour Party from instituting royal commission into something that he doesn't want to talk about. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I think the Labour Party has committed themselves to the Royal Commission and its follow-through. I think they supported it when it was announced, so I don't think they feel there's anything necessary to hide. But to go back to your other point, Professor Alex asking, is there any limit to the number of royal commissions we can have on the go at any given time?
No, there is no legal limit. There will be obviously resource limitations and limitations of time and so forth, but there is no legal limit to how many royal commissions that can operate at any given time. However, we should be mindful that having too many of these will cheapen the currency. The importance and gravitas, as someone said, of the Royal Commissions is because it's only used in appropriate situations where there is some public disquiet about some aspect of the administration of the government or some situation that has arisen in society. And if it is overused, obviously its value is going to be lessened. And so that's something that everyone has to be careful about.
Mary from WA says, Royal Commissions enable ordinary people to challenge the status quo and seek social justice as well as raise awareness and educate the public. An example being nurses, teachers and police whose psychological injury claims related to workplace bullying have been rejected. Normally, if your GP says you have a work-related injury, that is normally the only diagnosis one requires to access workers' compensation. Normally, only a medical doctor can give a medical diagnosis. A royal commission will offer much closer and impartial scrutiny when you are just one voice with no political power or clout. A royal commission can break down all of the barriers and hurdles that you would need to navigate in an attempt to seek justice and to improve the systems being examined. Finally, in government services, we are gagged and shut down. A royal commission cuts through the problematic barriers that government workers cannot traverse without putting their own lives at risk. Mary from WA. Do they embolden witnesses? If it's a royal commission, do people sort of think, I may not have given evidence at any other inquiry, but if it's a royal commission and I've got something I want to say, are people emboldened to think they really will get a fair and proper hearing, Professor?
I think that's quite right. And also, the royal evidence giver, witnesses giving evidence to a royal commission are protected, and they cannot be punished for what they have said at a royal commission. They have immunities from prosecution. They cannot incriminate themselves in giving evidence, and consequently, it is a much more protected environment in which to disclose facts.
Let's talk to Kane and Leon Gatha this morning. Your question relates to how they're announced and the public pressure involved, Kane.
Yes, good morning. I was just asking in regards to the public pressure, if there was enough public pressure on the government, would that be a reason to ask a royal commission into the government itself? So I'm assuming the public would be very interested to see about collusion and misappropriation of funds, like the Great Barrier Reef Fund that received that half a million dollar contract without being asked. I'm just wondering if there was enough public pressure, could there be a royal commission into the government itself?
Who would that public pressure have to be exerted on, though, Kane?
Well, it'd have to be, I assume, the government in charge at the time. So whether it probably now is probably the perfect time where you could use that as a leverage to say, well, whoever gets in needs to really look at the previous government or the government that's in that will be coming in to see what has been misappropriated over the last few years.
Well, good question. Thanks, Kane. Professor, have there been royal commissions initiated by one government into a previous government activities? Is that sort of thing likely?
not really. I don't think that has happened as a matter of general inquiry into a previous government's conduct. You see, we do have elections and we do have parliament to look into these things, and matters of policy are not really... Matters of policy are appropriate for a royal commission, but not in such general terms as to evaluate the performance of a government, past or present. So, with regard to actually specific acts of criminality or lawlessness, we must remember that. At least at the state level, there are permanent crime and corruption bodies to which people can complain. There is ICAC in New South Wales and the Victorian Office of Police Integrity. Queensland has the Crime and Misconduct Commission, and Western Australia has the Corruption and Crime Commission. Now, there is no comparative body at the Commonwealth level, and that's one of the things that has been discussed in recent years. So there are mechanisms by which the actions of a government can be alternative mechanisms that can be used to look into unlawful activities of a government. But general performance of a government, it's a matter for the public and matter for the politics, the political system.
And I suppose for us at the ballot box.
Exactly. And in fact, the general election has sometimes been referred to as the Grand Inquisition of the nation. So it is at the general election that the performance of a government in a democratic system is evaluated by the general public.
It's 5 to 3 in Western Australia. We are talking Royal Commissions on Overnights here on ABC Radio with Emeritus Professor of Public Law at the University of Queensland, Professor Suri Ratnapala. A couple of questions to wrap up, Professor, in a moment, but I want to squeeze in this call from John in Mona Vale. John, your question or comment relates to your service in Vietnam, does it?
Yes, that's right. I was a national serviceman in the 1960s and... so-called volunteered to go to Vietnam. I've been diagnosed over the years with leukemia, and now I've just had 30 radiation treatments for malignant facial cancer. But I visited the Australian War Memorial after the Royal Commission into Agent Orange, and there was a newspaper headline. You know how they used to put them in the brackets outside the news agents?
Oh, yes.
And it said, Agent Orange not guilty, you know.
Mm.
So I wrote to the War Memorial and said, well, if it's not guilty, how come the government is paying me a pension for it, you know? And I was on a landing barge carrying tanks and what have you in Vietnam, and we only wore shorts, sandals, and no shirt, you know? And the planes would come over spraying, and you'd get wet from it, you know? And they'd say, oh, it's only for flies and mosquitoes. But not only that, my children, my daughter... And my daughter and grandchildren, I've all started to develop cancers, like massive melanomas and all sorts of genital defects and what have you, you know. So, you know, and it depends on who you're taking on. Like, they took on the really big chemical companies, you know, and they were very selective about who could give evidence, you know. A lot of the Vietnam veterans weren't allowed to give evidence, you know. And I just feel that, you know, the outcome was, I mean, I get a really good pension and everything else, but your health is not worth that, you know.
John, can I ask what your prognosis is?
I don't know. I've got to get a scan in 3 months' time to find out whether I'm okay or not, you know.
No, but, certainly.
I'm 74 now, but I'm not really sad about it because I've had a really good run, you know.
Okay.
You know, and I was lucky. I got out of Army and got a job with what's now the Australian Border Force, and I worked there for 20 years, you know. So that was a good job, you know.
Well, but, on behalf of all of us, look after yourself and thank you for your service.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks, John. Yeah, it just goes to show how personal these inquiries can be, Professor. And to that point, before we let you go, I think one of the things too is that with the information that we've heard or evidence we've heard in some of the Royal Commissions lately, they're deeply upsetting and people want someone held to account, including criminal prosecution. Do they usually end up that way? Is someone or a lot of people held accountable for their actions?
Some have been. The difficulty, of course, is that to prosecute someone for a criminal act, there must be sufficient admissible evidence. We must remember that evidence given to royal commissions need not be strictly in accordance with the law of evidence, the evidentiary rules. But in a court of law, there is the burden of proof and there is a number of rules of evidence where some types of evidence cannot be accepted. And it's quite a different proposition to actually secure a conviction in a court of law. But it is a start. What the Royal Commission reports do is to disclose the facts that come up in the inquiry, and it can lead to the gathering of more evidence that can be admissible in a court of law, and then it is up to the prosecution, the DPP or whoever is the appropriate authority at state level and federal level, to pursue them. So it is the recommendation of a royal commission does not automatically lead to legal consequences.
Right. We're going to have to leave it there, Professor. The news is coming, but being very good to get your informed perspective and expertise on the topic this morning. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on the program.
Emeritus Professor of Public Law at the University of Queensland, Professor Suri Ratnapala, as we've had our talking point this morning on Royal Commissions.
This is a podcast from ABC Overnights.